This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. This past week has tested my patience. No, I'm not talking about being stir crazy in our locked up COVID environment. I'm talking about itching to talk about Robinhood and the mini financial insurrection that's been brewing. While I've been stewing on this for a little while, I've been talking to some friends in the hedge fund business. Most think I'm a little crazy because I believe that the finance industry can be a force for good in the world. In these conversations, I did find someone who believes me, hedge fund investor and Princeton finance ethicist, J.C. DeSwan.
Finance is a force for good. That's my fundamental belief. But it's often corrupted by the pursuit of self-interest defined too narrowly without consideration for the broader impact on society.
Finance as a force for good? I know that sounds a little naive and to some a bit ridiculous. But I think back to season one's guest, Fahmi Quadir. Remember, she's the famed short seller known as the assassin. I like to imagine that CEOs and boards of badly behaving companies have nightmares about this woman. But even if I am naive, my optimism is not deterred. Today, we talk with someone who is not at all shy about talking about a conflicted finance industry and the aspiration that finance can be a force for good. Let's talk with hedge fund manager and Princeton finance ethicist, J.C. DeSwan. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, J.C. DeSwan. J.C., hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me, Dawn.
Oh my gosh, you must be beside yourself this week. There's so much to say about finance ethics. Here we are in the middle of a, I don't know, can we call it a finance insurrection?
Yes, no, it's been fascinating.
Okay, so JC, tell our listeners what has been going on with the day traders on Reddit who are passionate about GameStop and maybe just putting it to hedge funds generally. How do you see what's going on and give us a little bit of the backstory?
You know, when you step back from it, there are a few very real concerns. On one hand, there's an interesting trend here, which is the democratization of investing. And that's actually what Robinhood is framing itself as. It's really trying to pitch itself as a tool to democratize investing. And there's a long history of a lot of folks in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. not being able to access the stock market because it was seen as more of an upper middle class way of investing your savings. And it was seen as benefiting the upper middle class. And frankly, I remember when I came out of grad school, when I would invest, you know, I got a brokerage account. And I remember when I would invest in stocks, it would cost me $250. Every time I invested, even if it was $1,000, right? And that was absurd. And that certainly deterred me from investing. And over the years, those fees have gone down. And you had the Schwabs and the Fidelities that brought down to $5. And now all of a sudden, you have Robinhood that says it's going to be zero fees, right? So on one hand, there's a very positive development here, which is offering a platform that essentially anyone can join to invest in the stock market. But there are some real concerns here. And one of them is that, well, on one hand, when you see these stock prices go up randomly, they're bringing valuation incredibly far away from any metrics that make sense. And it makes these companies completely unhinged. So, for instance, GameStop has been the focus this week. The stock price is completely disconnected from the company's actual economic prospects. At some point, that stock price is going to come down. And just for context, this is a stock that was trading at $20 about, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, and it's been brought up to a peak of $500 this week. Now it's at $325. But what that means is that now the stock market is valuing this company at $22 billion. This is not a company that has attractive prospects, right? It's a brick and mortar gaming retailer that was not doing particularly well.
No, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm listening to you think through this like a hedge fund guy, right? Like a rational, sane finance person. You're like, well, this doesn't match. There's this disconnect. But just take the name Robinhood, right? It's like,
yeah,
rob from the rich and give to the poor. I mean, do you think that there's not so much a get rich quick thing, but maybe just like stick it to the man, and by the way, make a little bit of money on the side?
Absolutely. That's been a very important dynamic here, which is there's an underlying current of anger at inequality for good reasons. And recently, the object of that anger has been hedge fund managers, which is completely understandable as one group of individuals who have disproportionately benefited from the system for no particularly good reasons. Now, the issue, though, with Robinhood is not necessarily that they're making this like trading free. The issue is that they're gamifying investing in very unhealthy ways, right? The way they promote stocks. We've seen this through history where the crowd will pile into stocks just because of momentum. And ultimately, it's unsustainable. And we know that a lot of people are going to lose money, and it's often going to be retail investors. It's not that big of an issue if it's the professional investors, because, I mean, they're paid to take that risk. But when I look at it from the Robinhood perspective, I see a real challenge here, because from my perspective, it sounds like they're being helpful when in reality, they're pushing their customers to do things that you would actually tell your own daughter or son or family members not to do. What they're saying is, we're encouraging people to trade often. And we know that trading often is a negative value proposition for most people. And in fact, what's interesting here is that if you're angry at the system and feel like managers are free riders, which is, you know, not an unreasonable perspective, the reality is you should put all your money into something like Vanguard, right? Because Vanguard, one is that it's almost no fees, right? Vanguard, in fact, is set up as a mutual company, so it's owned by its customers. But we've also seen that over the years, the best way to do well with your savings is to own the index. And in fact, if you had owned the index, you would have outperformed the vast, vast, vast majority of hedge funds. So not only you're taking money away from them by giving it to institutions that really don't take much fees on the way, but you're also going to outperform them.
Well, JC, I think you may have a second career as a investment advisor to insurrectionists.
I don't know.
Well, let's tell our listeners a little bit about your background, who you are, and how you get to a conversation with What Does It Profit about the finance industry.
So I divide my time between teaching and investing. So for the last, say, dozen years or so, I have taught in the economics department at Princeton University. And there, the focus of my teaching and research is, on one hand, ethics in finance, and on the other hand, Asian economies and capital markets. And then outside of Princeton, I work for Cornwall Capital, which is a New York-based investment fund. And it's a very small, very quirky fund that has a broad mandate that allows us to invest essentially in anything, anywhere. And my kind of background getting there was that I studied economic development in grad school. And I was always fascinated by this idea of finance as a force for good and as a tool to foster prosperity and as a way to spur economic development. And after grad school and a little bit of time in management consulting, I moved to institutional investing. And there, I wanted to invest in emerging markets as a way to test that idea that if you invest in emerging markets, you could actually be helpful to these economies. And it took me probably a couple of weeks to realize that I would have literally zero impact on these economies because I was just trading in the market with other hedge funds. And there was really no impact on just your average person in these economies. And that spurred me to try to think deeper and try to be more thoughtful about what is it about finance that's a force for good. And so that's how I ended up carving out this portfolio of activities where I both like teach and invest.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me, this balance between thinking of the deeper kind of ethical, moral issues and the actual going out and doing it. Last season on What Does It Profit, we had the short seller phenom, the assassin, they call her, Fahmi Qadir, who is, you know, well known for her short positions on Valiant and then more recently Wirecard, that crazy business of money laundering going on out of the German stock exchange. And so that's actually been a very heavily downloaded episode, I think, given kind of what's going on with the questions around short selling. But I think, you know, more more generally, we could say that there has been a very profound extractive quality to the finance industry. How do you see it, and how does that inform looking for something better?
The way I think about it is that over the last few decades, there have been some structural changes taking place on Wall Street that have essentially increased the conflicts of interest that are faced on an everyday basis by finance professionals. So there have been, you know, structural challenges. And at the same time, there are behavioral challenges. And I think one of them is that finance has grown to be such a complex, opaque industry that it's proven to be particularly fertile grounds for cognitive biases. I mean, Wirecard is a perfect example of that, where we see a lot of good people making bad decisions, right? This was a national champion in Germany, one of their few tech companies that was large and globally competitive. And there was so much desire to see it succeed that you see all these very thoughtful public servants making terrible decisions because of the inability to see the facts as they are in front of you, because you're so deeply embedded in a system of incentives and pressure points that you have a hard time seeing things the way they are. And, you know, it was just announced, for instance, that the head of BaFin, the financial regulator in Germany, had to resign because of that. And there's no question in my mind that he's a good person. And it's just that he wasn't able to look at the facts straight.
I can understand the impetus for wanting your own country to have a meaningful impact in the world in the fintech space, because that's the next generation. I mean, we're there already, but I mean, that's the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But what you see with Wirecard has been repeated over and over again, and certainly with auditing firms, right? I mean, in this case, the auditing firm took years and years to actually surface the fact that this was a fraud. And it's partly because of this cognitive bias, where you tend to put aside all the facts that are going to be negative to your own interests. So there's this concept of motivated blindness, right? The tendency to screen out others' unethical behavior, when if you acted upon it, it would impair your own interests. And that was the case certainly with situations like Enron almost 20 years ago. That was the case with Satyam in India 10 years ago. And now it's the case with Wirecard.
Yeah, tell our listeners, I guess we're kind of assuming that everybody knows what Wirecard, what business they're in, and kind of what went wrong. But maybe you could give us a brief reminder.
This is so national tech champion in Germany. And starting in the, I think it's 2015, there was a lot of smoke around this company, in the sense that Dan McCrum, a Financial Times reporter, started writing about this company and saying there were a lot of suspicious accounting, particularly in their Asia operations. And he started pursuing it as an investigative reporter. And unsurprisingly, he got a lot of pushback from the company, but surprisingly, he started getting a lot of pushback from the financial regulator in Germany. And it's one of these issues where it took literally 5 years for the auditing firm to finally put up the red flag and say, hey, there's actually fraud here. And it's a pattern that you see over and over again. And in this case, there was massive fraud. I mean, there was an enormous part of their balance sheet that wasn't there. There were a lot of fake transactions there. And in hindsight, you wonder, how is it possible to see this happen? But you see it repeatedly and the auditing firms, and it's not one specific auditing firm. It's all the top auditing firms go through this process, because they have so much motivation and interest to serve their customers and to keep them over time, that it's actually in their interest not to dig too deeply. And there's some complacency, in the sense that when you audit a firm over and over again, you end up cutting corners and not asking for, you know, the receipt and the bank statements in the way you would have done in the first few years of your auditing relationship.
Sure. In your book, Seeking Virtue in Finance, Contributing to Society in a Conflicted Industry, you identify three problems in the industry. We've talked about complexity. We talked about things being opaque. We're getting a sense of this third problem, which is information asymmetry. How do you see these getting sorted out?
Well, I think ultimately regulation is going to be the most important piece here, but there are other ways I think that would complete, because it's going to be a mosaic of pressure points. And the mosaic of pressure point would include regulation on one side. It would include, I think, shareholder activism, which is an increasingly potent way to affect the industry. And then the other piece, and that's the piece that I've really explored in this book and in my own research over the past few years, is for finance professionals to try to become more thoughtful about their impact on society. And so that's why I was interested in researching ethical role models in the industry to try to understand what could we learn from them. What are the patterns of behavior of inspiring people that have constructive behaviors that are helpful to society?
Well, you know, I remember reading in your book about a fascinating young accountant who actually took a pause from a big accounting job, took those skills over to Rwanda to really plant the seeds to make a difference in building a whole new sustainable economy. What'd you learn in that research?
Well, a number of things. So you're referring to Erin Goddard, who's a young lady that I connected with a few years ago. And I was looking specifically for examples of ethical role models that were able to utilize their skill set as finance professionals and use them to help society outside of their finance job, right? And so it can be in parallel to their jobs, or it can be after they leave the industry. So I connected with Erin about 3 years ago, and she had been an accountant for Ernst & Young in Toronto for about 5 years and had spent a summer in Kigali in Rwanda to volunteer. And so she had volunteered at a not-for-profit, and she came back with this deep insight, which is that in a developing economy like Rwanda, the corporate sector is incredibly challenged by the dearth of accounting skill set. When you look at the number of accounts per the population in Rwanda versus Canada or any other developed economy, it's dramatically different. And the net effect of that is that a lot of companies in Rwanda and also not-for-profits simply don't have the accounting skill set in their organization. And that means that their numbers are often not particularly solid. And so as a result, by definition, you're going to manage this company a little bit blindly. And that creates an enormous challenge in order to manage companies and not-for-profits. So she came back to Ernst & Young and decided that she could have so much impact by going back to Rwanda full-time. And so she did that shortly after going back to Toronto and deciding that she wanted to make that pivot. And there, like, she created an accounting academy. And so you fast forward today, and she brought a colleague from Ernst & Young to do this full-time with her. They are training cohorts of more than 100 students at a time. And after 13 weeks of training, so these are students who would have graduated from their undergraduate degree. And after 13 weeks of that training, they are job ready and they can go and work for a company or a not-for-profit. And now they can instill a much more accounting discipline in these companies. And that has an enormous potential impact at a small level, of course, because these are not huge cohorts. But if you think of the impact that she has at such a young age, it's remarkable. And, you know, it's something that I can certainly learn from.
Yeah. So she did that outside of her work. But did you run across any examples of people who are actually good examples, just kind of doing their day-to-day thing within the typical job family of what we find in the finance industry?
Oh, sure. I ended up looking at about 60 individuals and firms. And from them, I kind of teased out a framework of how to be virtuous in finance. There are four pillars: serving your customers faithfully. And then secondly, about serving your customers faithfully without extracting value from the rest of society and ideally adding value to society. And then the third one is about treating your colleagues and employees with dignity and helping promote diversity within the firm and within the industry. And then finally, citizenship, which is how to utilize your skill set, your finance skill set, to promote goals outside of your job, which is, you know, Erin Goddard. But there's lots of examples.
See, I think of, you know, where you started in that list that struck in my mind. I mean, you could be an absolutely terrific, let's say, banker and serve your client really well, but your client could be doing some pretty shady things.
Yes, absolutely. That's the challenge, right? And that's the area that I think finance as a whole can be more thoughtful about, because the most important mandate that we have as finance professionals is, of course, serving our customers' interests. But the challenge that you could do that well, but do so while extracting value from society. So, I can give you an example, for instance, of investment banks serving the governments of Italy and Greece in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Goldman Sachs advised the government of Italy, JP Morgan, the government of Greece, and they helped them essentially obfuscate the level of government debt that they had at the time, because these debt levels were going up and they were going above the maximum threshold that was mandated by the European Union, right, which was about 3% of GDP. They knew that they were going to go above that and that they were going to be fined, and they wanted to mask that. And so they asked these investment banks to do essentially financial engineering. And these investment banks managed to do that. And so when you step back from it, this is a good example of a situation where JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs would have served their customers really well. And they would have, you know, certainly made a lot of money from that. But from the perspective of these governments, there aren't that many firms that would have the depth of knowledge around financial engineering and also like an incredibly good handle on financial regulations. So they were able to do that. But when you step back from this, the challenge is that now they enable these countries to have more debt than they were supposed to. You fast forward to 2011, 2012, and you have a Eurozone crisis, which is really essentially about too much debt in the system. And I'm not faulting these banks, and I don't want to zero in on Goldman and JP Morgan. This is more of a proxy for investment banking. But this is an example where you would have served your customers well, but you would have probably destroyed some social value in doing so. I apply the framework to Robinhood. In my mind, it's negative in the sense that, you know, the first two pillars of the framework about serving your customers and not extracting value from society, you could look at Robinhood and say they're not really serving their customers well because they're pushing them to do things that you would never want people that you care about to do. And secondly, the net effect of that is that they're creating havoc in the market. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but the way they're doing it is by creating all sorts of asset bubbles. And the asset bubbles always end up having a reckoning and a negative impact.
Well, that gets us to our show's quintessential question, which is, in your case, a better and more ethical finance industry, what does it profit? What does it benefit the broader society?
You can look at it at a macro level, you can look at it at a micro level. At a macro level, finance is a force for good, which is that when it's not corrupted, it helps economies grow better. It fosters innovation. It allows people to innovate more. It improves corporate governance. At a micro level, it allows individuals to achieve their goals, right? So if you look at, I mean, we talked about Robinhood, but let's look at FinHabits is a robo-advisor that specifically focuses on the low-income Hispanic community and tries to get them to save, put money aside every month to put into a 401k. The fees are incredibly low. And so here's a force for good, right? Because most of the folks that they're going after are unbanked. So they're trying to get them into the system. They're not getting them to pay much fees at all. And they're trying to get them to save for their retirement. And so ultimately, this is an example of finance as a force for good. And I should mention as an aside that I'm a small investor in that firm. But it struck me, and that's one of the reasons, is because I felt that it struck me as a firm that could both have interesting economic prospects, but really like help society in its own niche way.
Well, JC, you put your money where your mouth is, true disclosure. So I want to thank you for living out what you research and teach. So JC, thanks for finding a little bit of time for us today. I always enjoy talking to you and hope you come back sometime.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Don. I enjoyed this.
You've been listening to What Does It Profit? Thanks to those who've gotten the word out about the show. This week, we want to give a special shout out to our friends across the pond, my fellow researchers and advisors at VIRTUE, V-I-R-T-E-U, which is the acronym for VAT Fraud, Interdisciplinary Research on Tax Crimes in the European Union. VIRTUE is advising the European Union on the interconnections between tax crimes and corruption. If this is something that interests you, go to virteu.com to join in the public dialogue online. In our next episode, we're going to talk with the Reuters corporate governance reporter. We will explore what has happened since the 181 CEOs of the Business Roundtable announced in 2019 a whole new vision for corporate governance, stakeholder capitalism.
That's why we looked at AT&T, because there was so much going on there. They signed the Business Roundtable pledge, promising, vowing to look at all stakeholders, and then within months agreed to a plan by one of the most well-known aggressive hedge funds. So we found that they were in a really tough position. They raised their dividend early last year, and then they did end up having to lay off a number of people. And that's how they ended up coming under the scrutiny of congresspeople like Elizabeth Warren.
Next on What Does It Profit? Reuters News Service corporate governance reporter Jessica DiNapoli. Until next time, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. We are hanging out mostly on LinkedIn and Twitter at the moment, and please don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. You can meet our team and sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. This episode was produced by guest producer Lucy Wang. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean. Other team members and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?